have to say, I personally think this is a good option because we got given, so before I started my jury service, I was sent in the post a pamphlet and I was sent an email with a link to the video basically explaining what it would be like to be a juror, the process of getting registered and checked in when I arrive, what my day schedule would look like if I was selected, what a juror's role involves, things like that. And they said, here is a link to an informational video about it, but you don't have to watch it beforehand as we will show you it on the first day. So I didn't watch the video beforehand because I thought, okay, I'll watch it on the first day. They'll be showing us there and then I can ask questions, things like that. I ended up not watching it on the first day. There was nothing prepared for the group to be watching it of new jurors that had started their jury service that week. There was not really anywhere you could ask questions. So I ended up actually watching it when I went home that day because I thought, oh, we're going to watch it before we started. We did not. And then when the trial started, my first trial that I was on, you get given a bunch of documents when you first went in there explaining your role, a route to verdict, a kind of any information that you need to know, the charges in detail, and kind of explaining what they are. But to be honest, not many people read it. It wasn't enforced really. It was off your own back to read it. The judge read it out once and there wasn't really a space to ask questions or anything like that. So I think an improvement in juror education, because there's kind of already stuff in place, but it's not enforced very well in England and Wales, that I think juror education training, it would be a good option of like reevaluating how jurors are educated and not trained, but I guess guided on being a juror. Another solution, which I think is should be something that is implemented, is the limiting of lawyers' use of rape myths during a trial. Right now, there are no guidelines limiting lawyers using rape myths during their trial. So this does not directly address underlying rape myth beliefs from jurors that they may bring to a trial off their own back and discuss in deliberations, but it would put a restriction in the way lawyers and barristers are able to invoke rape myths during a trial to try and undermine the credibility of a complainant. And this could reduce the prominence in which it features in jury deliberations, because if there is a limit on how lawyers and barristers are able to drop certain sentences and words in, it could stop, I would guess, like bringing it to the forefront of a juror's mind. Doesn't mean it's not already there, and like it said, it doesn't directly address jurors' bias, but it would potentially stop, I guess, a trigger of it, because you'll often see in cases lawyers being like, but did you see that the complainant was out drinking and wearing a mini dress and showing a lot of cleavage and things like that, and that will put something in certain jurors' heads, for example. And the final one, which is a bit of a controversial solution, there's very opposing sides to it, is judge-only trials. And it's argued to be one of the more extreme solutions due to the premise that it completely removes juries. So it guarantees a removal of rape myth bias in juries, but you can argue that it may simply replace it with a rape myth bias among particularly ill-informed judges, it might influence the bias in any way of a singular person. And judge-only trials means there'll be just one sole decision maker. So this, to me, I see why it's controversial, because yes, you remove bias from jurors and judges are more trained in being impartial and things like that, but a singular judge will lack representation of society, which juries give. You're looking at 12 people that are meant to represent your peers in society, to be a democratic, impartial body to decide the verdict. We know judges have a bias. You can see it in the statistics, if anything. You look at average custodial sentence lengths, especially if you look at it from an ethnicity standpoint. there is definitely some disparities in that. So there is already, we can see a bias in judges that way. Same with gender, there is a thing called leniency thesis, which looks at how judges will be more sympathetic in sentencing to women who are mothers or women who show a lot more remorse and things like that. Stereotypical female traits invoke a leniency thesis with judges. Also, judges potentially could have inappropriate motives when it comes to sentencing. We all know there is a really big problem with conviction rates for RASO cases, and the government, especially in England and Wales, is looking to improve that. So that might be putting pressure on the judges to be convicting more rape and serious sexual offence cases to make the picture look better than it is. So there could be a kind of inappropriate motive behind that if it's a judge-only trial. So yeah, those are the main potential solutions to the issue that is bias within jury decision making in RASO cases. It's an interesting way of looking at trying to improve the situation, but I think as well we should be looking at how can we intervene and prevent it before it even gets to this stage. Why we should be looking at rape myth bias, like I said, in the formative years in schools and in other contexts. I'll go back to my secondary school education back home, and I'm thinking when we get to the age of about 15 to 16, right towards the end of it, we were constantly being pulled up in assemblies for looking at our skirt lengths because it's inappropriate for the male teachers, and looking at the fact that we all had a uniform to wear. So we ought to wear a blouse, a skirt, blazer, and the blouses that we wore were white. So then there was a whole talk on you cannot wear any coloured bra under your white shirt. It had to be white or nude because it's distracting to the male teachers. So this idea that you put the blame on the girls for men getting distracted, for male teachers getting distracted, or male teachers acting inappropriately due to clothing decisions that were made by women. And even though it's not in a rape or serious sexual offence context, it is the same fundamental belief that is being pushed forward. And these are in your formative years of secondary school, so you're going to internalise that belief and take it with you further up. And we're going to see that, you see that in the rape myth bias research, but also you see it in the survivors and how they internalize and blame themselves when stuff like this happens to them. And I will also say, like, there's a scenario of if you look at parents. Now, parents will always worry about their children. That is just a given. But an example would be, for example, going out clubbing. You've just turned 18, you want to go out, and usually clubbing, you're dressing a bit more, I guess, revealing on a night out, and a parent suggesting, are you sure you should be wearing that? Are you not giving the wrong idea to anyone in the public, anyone that you see? You might be provoking them and giving the wrong idea, and this again puts the blame on the girl for actions of someone else. And I'm using the example of puts the blame on the girl from a guy's action, but it can be male or male as well, and it can be a female or male for all rapes. This idea that the blame gets put on the survivor or victim because of decisions made against clothing is a big one. It's just a big one that I can say that I've heard, not in the severity of the context that is rape and sexual and serious sexual offences, but just the context I've heard growing up of, like, trying to be safe, and like, it's a scary world out there for a woman alone, and that it feels like it's our responsibility to change what we want to do and our decisions because of someone else's. If I hope that makes sense, but in that kind of scenario. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to look at, and I think research should also be done looking into how we can prevent rape myth bias earlier on rather than when it gets to the actual trial stage, and looking at juries in that aspect. I'm going to play a couple songs now before I want to talk about a couple of statistics that I found that I think are interesting and really highlight the significance of this issue. So I'm going to start off with another song from the playlist that was recommended to me by our music coordinator, Connor. So this is a song called You Are Mine by Esha Tiwari off of her EP Wraith. It's a bit of an indie pop song. And then after that, I think I'm going to play a song called Pretty Distraction. I really like the lyrics to the song. I think it's a very appropriate song for the topic that I've chosen. So I'd really recommend really listening to the lyrics of it. It's by the artist Sky Daddy, and it's a single. So it's just called Pretty Distraction, another Femcon song. And then I will be back right after that to talk a bit about some statistics. God, I cannot speak tonight. Some statistics before I switch over to give the airwaves over to Connor for 2 hours from 8 to 10 p.m. with Bitcoover. So yes, this is the song You Were Mine by Esha Tiwari. Thank you.
and a smile. Naive, baby, don't think twice if it comes with a price. Run for your life. They're always trying to take what's not theirs. Drives me insane, it's not fair. Wants to be left alone. What a horrible world for all of the girls getting catcalled as they're walking home. With keys in her hand, you don't understand what she's had to do to get here. What a beautiful life for a woman who knows what she's worth and knows why she's here. A pretty distraction, they told her to cover up her shoulders, cause the boys couldn't focus. Maybe they should teach him to control his own actions, but that's not what happens. They're always trying to take what's not theirs. Drives me insane, it's not fair. What a terrible life for a woman who just wants to be left alone. What a horrible world for all of the girls getting catcalled as they're walking home. With keys in her hand, you don't understand what she's had to do to get here. What a beautiful life for a woman who knows what she's worth and knows why she's here. He says, what a pretty distraction. She's just what I need. And I know she'll be mine by the end of the night if I make her as insecure as me. What a terrible life for a woman who just wants to be left alone. Why she's here.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
And welcome back to Sociologic here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where you are tuned in for about the next 12-ish minutes to my lovely theme of rape and serious sexual offence trials. And then coming up from 8 to 10 p.m. is Bitcoover with our music coordinator, Connor. He's got a very exciting interview and a very fun show planned. So I very much recommend staying tuned for that. And to finish up, I kind of want to go through some statistics, which just, I would say, really highlight the severity of the issue that is around rape and serious sexual offence trials and the jury decision making going into it and the rape myth bias surrounding it. So if we look at, I've got stuff from England and Wales and stuff from Canada as well. So if we're going to start off with England and Wales, in 2022, more than 99% of rapes reported to police did not end up in a conviction. Now, this is going from the report to conviction. So not all reports make it through the Crown Prosecution Service and then through to court for a conviction. So that's just going from the start of someone reporting it to the police to two convictions of the total number, more than 99% do not get a conviction. And you can break this down a bit more. In December of 2021, there were 67,125 rape offences recorded by the police, which for one, for then, was an all-time high. Yet only 2,409 were completed prosecutions, which led to only 1,409 convictions. So you can see the number, how significant of a gap it is. So 96.4% of rape offences recorded by police didn't even result in a completed prosecution, so like a charge for it to then go to trial. So the big number for me is looking at the police recordings to charges. That's where a lot of cases get lost. There are also figures from one English police force over a two-year period that indicates 36% of acquaintance rape trial defendants concluded with a guilty verdict. So this is where the accused was known to the complainant in some way, compared to stranger rape defendants where there is no previous... they were previously unknown to the complainant. They were convicted in 73% of trials. So this is with... This really strongly shows the rape myth that believes that most rapes are done by strangers and that rape cannot be done by someone that you're known, and that marriage is a given consent when you're married or when you're in a relationship with someone, which is just simply not true. That statistic clearly highlights that rape myth when you look at the disparity of stranger to acquaintance rape. And if we look at Canada, there was a general social survey on Canadian safety, which is self-reported data collection, in 2019, which saw 6% of all sexual assault incidents were reported to police, in comparison to 36% of physical assaults reported to the police. So this highlights a very clear thing that not all rape survivors are going to go and report that to the police. So the idea that if you don't report it, it didn't happen, simply not true. You can also look at from 2015 to 2019, police services in Canada reported 115,859 sexual assaults, with 36% resulting in charges being recommended by police. Only 36%, which is a very small number. And we can see just a rise in sexual violence in general. In the UK, 1 in 12 women in England and Wales are affected by violence against women and girls. Incidents of rape and sexual assault recorded by the police increased from 2009-2010 to 2023-2024. It increased from 34,000 to 123,000, which is a ridiculously big jump. In Canada, there were... the rate of police reported sexual assault increased by 38% between 2017 and 2022. 87% of sexual assaults where the accused was charged by the police were known by the survivor. And that's from 2024 in Canada. Again, reiterating that myth that rape doesn't occur to people that are known to each other. Where that statistic clearly shows it does. 4.7 million women in Canada have been sexually assaulted since the age of 15, with Indigenous women being three times more likely to be sexually assaulted than non-Indigenous women. And that is from 2024 as well. So this proves that this is a very pivotal issue in that we are seeing a rise not only in sexual violence, but in gender-based violence against women, and a lot more femicides happening. And I also want to talk about, I did mention it on a previous show with, on a previous sociologic show with Corey, but we spoke about multi-perpetrator rape cases in Canada, particularly the one that is ongoing at the moment, which is one woman against five men from a junior hockey team. This is where the jury has been dismissed twice due to inappropriate behavior from defense lawyers. So it will be a judge-only trial verdict now. And the defense, I looked at some of the defense closing statements, and they are littered with rape myths being invoked. And it's already a complex case due to like consent and alcohol and differing stories. But it's a very interesting looking at the defense statements. And when you know what examples of rape myths there are and seeing this occur, it's quite, I would say, scary to see how many are being invoked. And it'll be interesting to see what the verdict is, since it is a judge-only trial, which is one of the proposed solutions, and it's kind of a very new solution for these types of cases. So the verdict is going to be given on July 24th of this year, if people want to keep a lookout for that to know the outcome. I'm personally very intrigued. But yeah, that is what I have for you tonight, as we're coming up to the end of the hour. Talking a bit about the problems with jury decision making in rape and serious sexual offense cases. I hope you enjoyed tonight's episode. And I don't know, maybe have a look at the case, look at the defense statements and see what you notice from it. I think it's an interesting thing that I think more people should be educated on, especially when we're looking at something that you could be called up for jury service and you could make a difference if you know these things to look out for. Also, because it is just societal misconceptions about a very serious crime. So, yeah, stay tuned. We have Bitcoover coming up next with Connor and his very exciting episode and interview. And I'm going to leave you with this last song called Late Slap by Dana Givansky. And I hope you all have a lovely rest of your evening and week. And I'll see you next week.